Green Bay's choice for news talk. 1590 AM and 97.9 FM WGBW.
ABC News, I'm Dave Packer. Racist text sent to black students and business people in at least 24 states. Dr. Robert Green is an assistant professor of history at Clapham University in South Carolina.
I think it's fear-mongering. It's surly intimidation.
The text addressed to the recipients by name and told them to get on a bus, take them to a plantation to begin slave labor. The FBI, police, and states investigating. Russia's deputy foreign minister says the Kremlin's open to hearing President-elect Trump's proposals on ending the war with Ukraine. A federal judge has canceled all court deadlines in Donald Trump's 2020 election interference case following his presidential victory. Prosecutors are now deciding on the next steps, given Justice Department rules barring the prosecution of a sitting president. Firefighters in Southern California say calmer winds have helped them make progress against a Ventura County wildfire that's destroyed more than 130 buildings. About 2,000 buildings are still under evacuation orders. This is ABC News. In Amsterdam, Israeli soccer fans attacked and beaten by violent mobs after a match against the Dutch team, ABC's Ian Pannell.
Dutch officials say the attacks fueled by calls on social media before the game to target Jews. But tension had also been building for days. Despite a ban on pro-Palestinian demonstrations near the soccer stadium, protesters showed up anyway, expressing anger over the wars in Gaza and Lebanon. And according to online postings, they were prepared for violence.
In Wisconsin, a 13-year-old Kenosha student has been charged with terroristic threats after being arrested on suspicion of plotting a school shooting. Local police say the teen tried to enter Roosevelt Elementary School on Thursday with a large black bag and reportedly left after being questioned by security. He was later arrested at his home, where officers found several airsoft replica handguns and a replica rifle. The suspect allegedly telling a social worker he went to the school with the intent to scare students. Dave Packer, ABC News.
Progressive presents Employee of the Month. Small Business Edition. Today's recipient from Lucky Larry's Landscaping, Larry! Larry saved his business money with a quick commercial auto quote from Progressive. Does it help he's his own marketing manager, accountant, executive assistant, and never been late? Technically, yes, but saving really put him over the edge. So, Larry, give Larry a round of applause. Be your own, Larry. See if you could save in as little as 7 minutes at ProgressiveCommercial.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates.
Hey, it's John Mino.
And Jim Schmidt from Mino and the Mayor.
Want to stay in the loop with all things Northeast Wisconsin? Sign up for the WGBW weekly newsletter.
Get the latest local stories, updates on the weather, and a special feature from our Mino and the Mayor podcast.
It's your one-stop shop for real news and great conversations in Northeast Wisconsin.
Log on to WGBW.FM today and get signed up.
Real news, great conversations. Sign up today at WGBW.FM/newsletter.
I'm Lisa Hale with WGBW News. Your news in depth. Find it in the news section at WGBW.FM.
For Civic Media News, I'm Savannah Tomei Olson. This was our first election with Wisconsin's new maps, and experts say they made a difference. Here's Judith Ruiz Branch.
Although Republicans still have the upper hand, their supermajority is quashed, and Democrats made some key gains in the Wisconsin legislature, which they believe puts them in a better position to gain chamber control in 2026. Political scientist David Helpap with the University of Wisconsin at Green Bay says this lays the groundwork for changes in future policy proposals.
As districts become more competitive, it makes it more difficult for those who are elected officials in those districts to really propose policies that are too far left or right of center, simply because they know they're going to have to answer to voters that are more center than they used to be.
He says the new legislative maps leveled the playing field for legislators in a way that Wisconsin hasn't seen in more than a decade. Until Governor Tony Evers came into office, Republicans had free rein in choosing which policies to push forward, Helpap adds. But Evers changed that dynamic overall, most recently with the new legislative maps. One of the biggest upcoming policy issues is the next state budget. From K through 12 education to funding local government, the UW system, and corrections, Helpap says that's where Wisconsinites could see the impact of these changes the most, and the dynamic will be different.
There's no doubt that Republicans still have the majority and they can sort of proceed in that fashion. But I think perhaps some folks will be thinking about the next election cycle and maybe the implications of specific decisions that they'll be making during this budget process.
For Wisconsin News Connection, I'm Judith Ruiz Branch. Find our trust indicators at publicnewsservice.org.
You're listening to Civic Media News. I'm Savannah Tome Olson.
Enjoying this local program? Find the complete Civic Media lineup at civicmedia.us or the Civic Media app.
With your forecast, I'm Corey Hartman. For today, partly sunny, highs in the mid-50s. Some showers tonight with a low of 46. Showers in 53 for Sunday. Sunday night, mostly cloudy, a little breezy, lows around 45. For Monday, mostly sunny, 53, and 50 for Tuesday.
It's 39 at our studios.
Dom Selvia.
Next time, it's not all doom and gloom. Jody Habish Sinekin, Wisconsin's 8th Senate District. She won. Plus, Harvey K. will talk about what happened and what comes next. Tune in.
The Dom Selvia Show, weekdays 4 till 6. The Talk of Green Bay, WGBW.
This is Amicus, a law review. My name is Jim Santel. I am your host here on the broadcast stations of Civic Media, both this hour and next hour as well. Delighted and honored to have you with me for this first hour, hopefully the second hour again here on Amicus. We take our name, as you know well, our adopted commission to conduct a review and analysis, some deliberation, some consideration even, of the recent news in our state, in our nation, in our world, in those areas of law and government and the aspiration for justice. Amicus, amicus, coming from the Latin, also a legal term meaning friend, sometimes friend of the court when it's described as an amicus curiae, someone who assists a decision-making authority in understanding things about the world, information, insight, perspective, that's necessary for the appreciation and understanding of that world. As those issues are being discussed, questions being resolved, amicus, a law review, thus our name. Once again, thrilled to have you with me and my wonderful producer, Greg, here in the broadcast studio of Civic Media. And as a part of that, as always, in this, our weekend, weekly examination of law and justice and the courts in America, taking your questions and your inquiries. That number is 855-752-4842. Once again, that's 855-752-4842. Greg always reminds me as well that you can be in touch with us by sending in your questions, your comments, your inquiries to Greg and me on the Civic Media app as well. Delighted, as always, to engage you in our syllabus, our academic agenda this weekend here on Amicus, a Law Review. We come, of course, together in the wake of a major event in American history that is going to be written about for all of American history and beyond, whatever the future may hold. That, of course, the election on Tuesday of the next president of the United States of America, his name, Donald John Trump. We're going to spend a lot of time talking about the consequences of that in the areas of the rule of law and justice and courts in our nation and, yes, in our state, in our communities as well, because all of those are dramatically impacted by whoever is elected our president. Donald Trump, a special presidency. We're going to spend a lot of our time not only talking in this hour and the next hour about the impacts, the practical impacts of what the American population has done to elect Donald Trump to the presidency, the impacts in particular upon those four criminal cases. You know them well because they've been a part of our discussions. You have seen them digested in the news, both here on Civic Media and in other places. We're going to talk about the status of those four criminal cases pending against, yes, that's right, the president-elect of the United States of America, two of those in state courts, two of those in federal courts as well. What is the status of those? What happens now that Donald Trump, in about 70 days from now, will be taking the oath of office as our chief executive. What happens in these next 70 days in those cases in New York, in Georgia, in Florida, and in Washington, D.C.? Two federal cases, two state cases. What's going to happen? And what has happened just late in this past week in the area of news, in the rule of law, that's going to affect dramatically at least one of those cases? We're going to talk with you about the status of each of those and make some fairly easy predictions about the future of those cases, even though they are all now pending. Remain in place. Remain in place, even as the Electoral College tells us that Donald Trump will be the next president of the United States of America. A lot of discussion about those. Again, inviting your questions and your inquiries about that. And then we're also going to be spending a lot of time talking about some broader issues, many of them following up on things that we have talked about in past broadcasts, things about the exercise of power by the Supreme Court, by the Congress, and yes, especially by the executive branch, by any president placed in the White House by the people of the United States of America. There are seven theses, 7 points, seven key observations I'm going to make, bringing together many of the things we have talked about. And the ultimate thesis, the umbrella over all of those, is just this, that in 70 days from now, as a result of what the American population, a majority of the American population, has decided to do, what will happen in December when the Electoral College gathers, in early January when the Congress gathers to count those electoral votes, the results of that are going to be a dramatic change in the power, yes, with a capital P, the power of our United States government, the federal government, certainly vested in a supreme presidency, an executive branch, the sort of which we have not seen before in 238 years of our national existence. Our Constitution, younger than that by just a bit, but under all of those principles that have guided us for the past almost 250 years, we are going to be witnessing in 70 days from now. What an amazing time to be alive in the history of our nation. We're going to be witnessing in just 70 days from now the beginning of something that Americans across centuries now have never seen before, and that is a powerful government. I hesitate to say all powerful because, as we talked last broadcast, there are standards, there are guardrails against a supreme presidency. But a presidency that, because of, as I am going to offer to you, the confluence, the bringing together of seven different principles, seven different things that have happened, seven different aspects of our Constitution, the laws, the way the government works, establishing by virtue of them all coming together under the presidency of Donald Trump, a Congress, the Senate of which is now going to be of the same party, Republicans occupying the majority of the Senate, and of course also the White House. Across the street at the Supreme Court, a Supreme Court also hugely supportive of this president, granting to him just in the previous term three major decisions that cemented in many ways his capacity to move on and gain the votes of a majority of Americans just a few days ago. Other issues related to the pardon authority, the ways in which the Department of Justice can in fact be used. We talked a lot about that the last time. The implications of a Senate and a presidency that can now put into place in all of the different cabinet offices and beyond people of this president's selection. And the confirmation of those nominations under the Constitution by a Senate that will almost certainly act quickly and without a whole lot of dissent, at least in the majority party, to ensure that the president's loyal supporters and loyal adherents to his policies and positions are in positions quickly to effectuate, to accomplish these powerful grants of authority that have been given to this president by the Supreme Court. Yes, by our Constitution, and promises that he has made during the course of his candidacy, ever since he left the White House and up until even this weekend, promises that he has made to exercise those authorities in ways that, once again, here is the premise. Here is the thesis that based upon those seven different things, we're going to see a presidency. We're going to see a government that we have not seen before, at least not in my lifetime, in yours as well. A government that exercises power and authority consolidated in a very few people, if not just one, under this thing called the unitary executive theory that we talked about at great length last time. Now we're going to see what that looks like. We're going to see what a unified government inside the executive branch really means. The capacity of a president to control agencies, not just around the cabinet table, but throughout the executive branch. Support from the Congress, support from the Supreme Court, a unitary executive that will be able to exercise, and according to what he has said, will exercise the powers now granted to him by a majority of the members of our population, granting him the presidency in 70 days. All of that and more is on our academic syllabus, our agenda for this weekend. We're also going to do a little bit of other rule of law news reporting, because other things are still going on. And yes, indeed, we're going to talk about some of those things that have animated the lives and livelihoods of all of us here in America, in Wisconsin, and beyond. Some of those in the categories of rule of law snapshots. We haven't done that kind of a segment in a long period of time. Seven or eight different stories in the areas of a decision by a federal judge to restrict, to limit, to stop President Biden's undocumented spouse's authority that he implemented just a week prior to the judge stopping that from going ahead, a major immigration decision, a major decision coming out of military judge reestablishing and putting back into place those pleas by the 9/11 conspirators in Guantanamo Bay, an additional life term imposed upon the attacker of Paul Pelosi. Remember that? A judge and a jury in California imposing a life term upon him, a conviction of a police officer responsible in part for the horrific, catastrophic, botched shooting that resulted in the murder of Breonna Taylor. We're going to talk about a trial being set for Eric Adams, the federal case against him for corruption charges. We'll talk a little bit about some late-breaking news, the Department of Justice indicting some Iranian nationals, yes, in Iran, for attempting to assassinate President-elect Donald Trump. That just coming out late this past week. And equally late this past week, we'll also mention that an Illinois judge invoking the Supreme Court standards under that Bruin case, that horrific Bruin case that says that you can only justify present limitations upon guns, upon firearms in America, if you can find some historical antecedent. An Illinois judge now just recently, just days ago, striking down the longstanding now ban established by the Illinois legislature on assault weapons, saying it's unconstitutional, can't do it based upon what the Supreme Court has said. All of those things also going on in America. All of those things going on in our communities, because all of those things impact each and every one of us. And of course, the most significant thing that is affecting all of us are elections. And we're going to begin with a couple of positive things, positive aspects of what Americans did, many of those having to do with individual elections around our nation, the elections of congressmen and congresswomen, senators and referendums. As Amicus Law Review comes back, we're going to talk about two of those that are especially important for your understanding here on the broadcast stations of Civic Media.
You're listening to the Talk of Green Bay, WGBW, home for Matt Nair on air.
The Todd Alba Show.
If you haven't tried mindfulness techniques before, the idea is to take a minute, focus on the present, not the past, not the future. Be here now. You can do it in your car.
Please not while you're driving.
I would say preferably not driving. Just take a moment and close your eyes and just breathe. Focus like on the breath coming into your body and out.
The Todd Alba Show, weekdays noon till 2 on your local Civic Media radio station and on the app.
Doctors Without Borders is delivering life-saving medical care where it's needed most in communities around the world. From bandaging war-wounded patients in Sudan to providing clean drinking water in Haiti, we're in more than 70 countries worldwide, bringing patients from sick to recovering, from emergency to aid, from crisis to care. This life-saving care is made possible by a global movement of supporters like you. Thank you.
You're listening to the Talk of Green Bay, WGBW.
This is Amicus Law Review. My name is Jim Santel, your host this hour and next hour. So much appreciating callers and commentators, those of you with questions as well, dropping questions into our text line as well. We're going to get to those because there are lots of things we're going to discuss this weekend on our broadcast. Beginning, of course, with the most significant event of this past week, arguably of the decade, candidly, maybe even of the entire history of America. That is the re-election of Donald Trump as the president of the United States, taking a second term, a non-consecutive term as the president, getting about 74 million of us to vote for him, 69 million or so voting for Vice President Kamala Harris. And that results in an electoral college of approximately 295 votes for Donald Trump, and approximately 226 votes, a couple of states, Arizona, Nevada, still coming in. Unmistakably, Donald Trump has won the presidency. What is the process by which this goes ahead? Well, again, once those states come in, we know that what we have done on Tuesday is actually not to elect a president by virtue of popular votes, but instead what we do is we elect electors, right? Under our Electoral College, James Madison wrote this into our Constitution. A lot of debate these days has been for decades about whether or not the Constitution and its Electoral College is an antiquated thing that should be thrown out. Lots of people on both sides of that argument arguing for a straight political and partisan and electoral vote that would establish who the presidency is. In this case, you would get a confluence and agreement between the Electoral College and that popular vote. But we know in past cases, significantly in our lifetimes, that presidents have been elected without the popular vote in America, but getting the most electoral votes. Again, Donald Trump will almost certainly, at the time that the Electoral College comes together, when on December 17th, the electors that we elected here in the state of Wisconsin, other states throughout the union, they will get together effectively. They will gather together and they will cast those votes. We have cast 10 of them here in the state of Wisconsin for Donald Trump. And those electors will join together with the electors from all other states on December 17th and actually cast those votes. And then in a very real way, that's the date on which the next president will be decided, although we know who that will be. And then the other significant date, which is also, of course, in your mind and in your thoughts these days, is January 6th. Once again, this is January 6th, 2025. That's the time when the Congress will convene. And the Speaker of the House of Representatives, Mike Johnson, will join the President of the Senate. Who is that? That's the Vice President of the United States of America. Her name is Kamala Harris. And on that date, on January 6th of 2025, they will take those Electoral College votes from that gathering on December 17th of this year, just a few weeks down the road. They will get together. They will open those envelopes, something we saw again 4 years ago, following which there was the great tumult, the criminal conduct, the horrific behavior that resulted in the loss of life and injuries to many, many people, the attempt to undermine and overthrow our government on that day. This day, January 6, 2025, anticipating a peaceful, as we have had, with that exception 4 years ago, all other times in our history, opening of those Electoral College votes, and almost certainly finding and certifying in front of the Congress that indeed Donald Trump has gotten enough of those electoral votes to become the next president of the United States of America. And then, of course, that happens on January 20th. Those are the dates coming up. That's the date that he will be on the west side of the Capitol building, now iconic in our memories and in our minds. And he will take the oath of office as the next president of the United States of America. We know that as a result of the election of just this past Tuesday, other things happened around the country. Again, all members of the House of Representatives elected. And that included a fellow named Gene Vindman. Gene Vindman, you may recall him well. He goes by Eugene. His real name is Yevgenia Vindman. He's a Democrat. He's a former Army lieutenant colonel. He was fired, you may recall, very notoriously for his role as a whistleblower in the first impeachment of Donald Trump. Remember that? He defeated on Tuesday a Republican named Derek Anderson. They won, they being Congressman Vindman now, won a competitive congressional seat in a district in central and northern Virginia. And as a result of that, Gene Vindman will be taking the oath of office in early January. The Congress comes in and they will be taking that oath of office at that time. As you may recall, Gene Vindman came to National Promise in 2019 alongside his twin brother, Alex, when the two of them gave some whistleblower accounts of Donald Trump's dealings with Ukraine, that asking for the Ukrainian president to engage in an investigation of who? Of Donald Trump's chief rival at that time, Joe Biden, and his son in particular, Hunter Biden. Obviously, the president of Ukraine declining that opportunity, but that resulted in the impeachment of Donald Trump. An unsuccessful impeachment resulted in the Senate trial finding him not responsible for that, or at least not removing him from the presidency at that time. Gene Vindman will be taking the oath of office as a new congressman coming out of Northern Virginia, Central Virginia this coming term. You may recall well that this particular campaign was marked by another interesting blip, if you will, in politics in America. Vindman criticized his opponent, again, Anderson, for some campaign photos and some videos that appeared to show that Mr. Anderson was sitting around a dining room table with his wife and three daughters. It turned out, in fact, that the candidate was sitting there with a female friend and three of her daughters. Democrats accused Anderson of trying to peddle a fake family view of his status and said he could not be trusted. Anderson himself said, "I'm unmarried, don't have any children," never claimed that those pictures were of his family members. That a part of that campaign, but now results in Gene Vindman coming into the Congress in the 119th Congress in just a few weeks. Another significant event coming up from the election of just this past Tuesday, and that is something that New York voters did. New York voters this past Tuesday approved an amendment to the state's constitution. This is no small thing. We've seen that here in Wisconsin as well. Barring discrimination, it's a civil rights aspect, a new aspect of their constitution, barring discrimination on things like gender identity and pregnancy outcomes. What did the language say in particular of this new constitutional provision? The amendment adds language to the state constitution that previously protected against discrimination for national origin and age and disability. Now, by virtue of what the voters in New York did, the constitution expands those categories of what we call immutable characteristics, the things based upon which no one should be discriminated against, the things that are also implicit and explicit in our federal and state laws in other areas prohibiting discrimination for people, against people, based upon things like, yes, national origin and age and disability. But also, here are the other new categories added to the New York Constitution: sexual orientation, gender identity, gender expression, pregnancy, pregnancy outcomes, and reproductive health care and autonomy. And the Constitution, once again, previously protected just race, creed, and religion. Those are no small things. But expanding the list of things for which there are now protections, of course, all of that changing the interpretation, not just of the Constitution, but going forward in a number of different areas that are out there. As we come back, more discussion about the impact of the election of just this past week here on Amicus, a Law Review.
You're listening to the Talk of Green Bay, WGBW, home of Mino and the Mayor.
ABC News, I'm Dave Packer. Racist texts sent to black students and business people in at least 24 states. Dr. Robert Green is an assistant professor of history at Clapham University in South Carolina.
I think it's fear-mongering. It's surly intimidation.
The texts addressed to the recipients by name and told them to get on a bus, take them to a plantation to begin slave labor. The FBI, police, and states investigating. Russia's deputy foreign minister says the Kremlin's open to hearing President-elect Trump's proposals on ending the war with Ukraine. A federal judge has canceled all court deadlines in Donald Trump's 2020 election interference case following his presidential victory. Prosecutors are now deciding on the next steps, given Justice Department rules barring the prosecution of a sitting president. Firefighters in Southern California say calmer winds have helped them make progress against a Ventura County wildfire that's destroyed more than 130 buildings. About 2,000 buildings are still under evacuation orders. This is ABC News.
This is your local Civic Media radio station. Want to hear even more? Anytime? Find all of it at civicmedia.us.
The Bucks lose to the Knicks. Hi, I'm Mike Clemens with sports. The Bucks got into New York City late Thursday night after winning at home against the Jazz. They lost last night to the Knicks at Madison Square Garden. The final, 116-94. Damian Lillard now on falling to just 2 wins and 7 losses so far this season.
You know, when you're in the type of situation we've been in, losing games and trying to find yourself and find identity and get going in the right direction, I think everybody's frustrated. You know, you don't want guys in here happy, not experiencing that when you lose losing games, but it's, like I said, it's frustrating. I think we gotta understand what we're doing and what it looks like when we're having success. You know, that starts with just, you know, simply competing, playing hard. And a lot of the games that we've struggled in, teams are just getting to loose balls more than us. They get into the glass more than us. They playing at a little bit faster pace than we are. That's giving them an advantage and putting us behind in these games. You know, we just gotta be much better about that.
That's the Bucks' Damian Lillard with sports. I'm Mike Clemens.
Local radio for you and your community. It's Civic Media's mission with stations across Wisconsin. Find your favorites at civicmedia.us.
With your forecast, I'm Corey Hartman. For today, partly sunny, highs in the mid-50s. Some showers tonight with a low of 46. Showers in 53 for Sunday. Sunday night, mostly cloudy, a little breezy, lows around 45. For Monday, mostly sunny, 53, and 50 for Tuesday.
Currently, 42 degrees.
Not to brag, but Progressive's Name Your Price tool is mankind's greatest tool ever. Even better than the wheel. Sure, without the wheel, we wouldn't have modern transportation or funny videos of dogs riding skateboards. But without the Name Your Price tool, we wouldn't have easy access to auto insurance options based on our budget. And, well, cars do need wheels. They also need insurance, and insurance never goes flat. Learn more about the greatest tool ever, the Name Your Price tool, at Progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law. Not available in all states.
The Dom Salvia Show.
Jeannie from Eau Claire.
I am thankful for Civic Media, the on-air talent, the technicians, the producers, the news staff, and especially Mr. Sage Wild. It's a very, very sad, shocking day for me, yeah. But I still have hope because I have hope in you guys. Keep up the great work.
Thank you, bye. Jeannie. You give us hope. Appreciate you listening.
The Dom Salvia Show, weekdays from 4 till 6 on the Civic Media Radio Network and on the Civic Media app, Nightlight with Pete Schwabba.
He's a comedian, a writer, and an actor. And teaches comedy, one of Wisconsin's own. Dobie Maxwell joins me here on Nightlight. Hey, Dobe.
Pete Schwabba, I am Chico. You're the man. Can you hear me? Is my Amish wood-burning computer plugged into the?
You got Amish.
Experience?
Oh, you got to update, buddy. I got gas powered and it's working like a charm. So it'll change your life.
Nightlight with Pete Schwabba, weeknights from 6 till 8 on your local Civic Media radio station and on the Civic Media app.
What I know about courage, I learned from my adoptive mom. She said, sometimes you just gotta hold on and know we'll get through this.
Mom, we are so high up. Hold my hand.
No, you hold my hand.
Here we go.
Learn about adopting a teen from foster care. You can't imagine the reward. Visit AdoptUSKids.org to find out more. This message is brought to you by AdoptUSKids, the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services, and the Ad Council.
Maggie Dawn.
Next, Jim Santel, former U.S. Attorney for the Eastern District of Wisconsin, is in the host chair for the Maggie Dawn Show.
The Maggie Dawn Show, weekday afternoons from 2 till 4.
This is Amicus Law Review. My name, Jim Santel. I'm your host this hour and also next hour here on the broadcast stations of Civic Media. Honored and delighted to have you with me for our discussion of all things courts, all things rule of law, all things administration of justice related. Joined here in the studios of Civic Media by my wonderful producer, Greg Bach, and together we're taking your phone calls at 855-752-4842. Also, your texts, dropping those into the Civic Media app. And we've already got some great inquiries coming in from you. Appreciate those so much. One of them having to do with the oath of office. The oath of office that all federal officials, all state officials, all municipal officials take to do what? To take care that the laws be faithfully executed and enforced. An oath to the Constitution, to the people of the country, to the county, to the state, to the municipality. We're going to talk about that oath of office, as one of you has already raised that question. Another one of you asked about the pardon authority of the presidency. And wow, is that a great question, because it's among those seven things that I'm going to talk about that change the capacity of our federal government, in particular of the executive branch, to act in Washington, D.C., that happening in a brief 70 days from now. The pardon authority, one of those seven key points I'm going to be talking about, as we have before. They're going to change the ways in which government, your federal government works in America. A huge amount of power to be exercised in a way that we have not seen in almost 250 years. We know that in the wake of the November 5th election, there are other events happening in the months just ahead. We talked already about the Electoral College getting together in December, the counting of those votes in January as well, and then the swearing in of the new president and vice president, along with other members of Congress, also that happening in January. There's something else going on that you should put on your calendars for next week, and yes, indeed, in the days right before we together in this nation celebrate Thanksgiving, a time of giving thanks for a nation that, regardless of your political perspectives and partisan views about things, is still, even as of this day, a nation built upon democracy and representative democracy that contemplates that a system of justice will move forward. Another one of our themes this weekend on Amicus. Why am I focusing on that particular issue? Because in a short 17 days from now, something else is going to be happening in American history that we have never seen before. And it gets us into our discussion of these four criminal cases pending against Donald Trump. 17 days from now, November 26, 2024. Let me say this as clearly as I can. The president-elect of the United States of America is going to appear in a Manhattan criminal courtroom to be sentenced for his 34 felony violations of New York state law. He's going to be appearing in a court 17 days from now to be sentenced for crimes that he committed. How do we know he committed those crimes? Because a jury of his peers, selected by defense counsel, selected by prosecution counsel, by the court, a jury of his peers made that determination unanimously, beyond a reasonable doubt, way back in May. And Judge Juan Merchan, who is the district court, the state district court judge responsible for the oversight of that case, has scheduled the sentencing of our president-elect for his crimes on that day, on November 26 of 2024. We've talked about this before. The judge has many options before him. These are Class E felonies. They amount to a possible exposure of up to 4 years in prison. And realistically, Donald Trump will not be sentenced to 4 years in prison. But Judge Merchan does have authority, does have capacity to do all sorts of other things in connection with that sentence, everything from the imposition of a probationary term to the imposition of fines, other restrictions that follow a felony conviction there in New York. And yes, indeed, has the capacity to order in his judgment, the final judgment in that case, the incarceration of the president-elect of the United States of America, the detention of his. Now, I need to hasten to add that will we anticipate that on November 26, Donald Trump, our president-elect, will go to prison? No. That will not happen on that day because almost certainly Juan Merchan will also do something else that most judges would do in these circumstances, regardless of what he does. Detention or some lesser sentence for these e-felonies in New York. He will almost certainly stay his judgment. That's the legal term that basically says I'm not going to require you to be taken into custody on this day. You can pursue your appeals, defendant Trump, president-elect Trump, to the appeals court and beyond that to the New York Supreme Court. You can pursue all of that. And it's only after all of that is exhausted, after you've done all those appeals, at that point then, assuming that those appellate courts also affirm the judgment, which includes the trial, the jury verdict, the sentence, all those things wrapped up into one, it's only after that that Donald Trump would be exposed, we'll get to that, exposed to the possibility of being detained and imprisoned, depending upon what Judge Juan Merchan does. So no incarceration, even if he orders that, but rather a stay of that judgment. But that will be happening on the 26th of this month, not next year, not next month, this month. The president-elect of the United States of America scheduled to appear in front of Judge Juan Merchan for his criminal sentencing found by a jury of Americans. A stunning thing to say out loud, a stunning thing, an unprecedented thing in American history. And then Juan Merchan has said something else, that even before that happens, he is going to issue his opinion. He's scheduled it for next Tuesday, this coming Tuesday, this business week coming up right now. He is going to issue an opinion on this. He has stayed his decision. He has withheld his decision, postponed his decision on whether that horrific Supreme Court case coming out of the high court on July 1 of this year, finding that a president has immunities, some of them absolute when it comes to the U.S. Department of Justice, many of the rest of them presumed immunities, that the things a president does are not subject to criminal prosecution, effectively permitting a president to commit crimes in office with impunity, a stunning decision. The question is whether or not that Supreme Court decision in any way requires that Judge Merchan dismiss the New York case, somehow order a new trial based upon evidence presented, or otherwise affects the going ahead of that sentencing on November 26. Juan Merchan has promised that he's going to issue his opinion, almost certainly finding, although we cannot say with absolute certainty, that that Supreme Court case, as stunning and horrific and terrible and constitution amending as it is, will not have an impact upon his sentencing a couple of weeks later. And he's going to do that for a couple of reasons, predictably. One is he's going to say that the Supreme Court case talks about official acts. Those are the ones that get some forms of immunity. And here Donald Trump convicted for what? For things that he did in his personal capacity, most of those before he was the president of the United States of America. That case, of course, premised upon things in October and November of 2016. Before that election, having to do with payoffs and fraudulent statements, fraudulent representations about those monies. That's the reason he was convicted. And yes, there's some tendrils into 2017 as well. But the judge will almost certainly say two things. One is, those are not official pieces of conduct by a sitting president, so the Supreme Court case does not apply. And secondarily, the timing is all wrong. The timing is all wrong because Donald Trump was not the president at that time. And so for those two reasons, predictably, Juan Merchan will say, no applicability here in this state prosecution. Hold on to that idea when it comes to other cases down the road, which we will talk about. But he'll issue that opinion as soon as this coming Tuesday and then presumably reaffirm his chances, his opportunity, his schedule to sentence Donald Trump on November 26. Now, between now and then, as all of this goes forward, are there going to be petitions to get that sentencing postponed? You bet there are. Absolutely. An aggressive and appropriate defense counsel would identify for Judge Juan Merchan and argue before him that the sentencing should not go ahead, postpone that because of the need to engage in transition for the new president, postpone it because he's going to be the president of the United States of America, renewing the basic motion again. Be interesting to see if Juan Merchan buys into that. Hopefully not, because at some point Juan Merchan has got to resolve this case. He's got to bring it to an end. He's already postponed the sentencing twice. You may recall back in July, right before the Republican National Convention was right here in Wisconsin. He postponed it then. He set it for September and then postponed it again now until November. Don't postpone this again, Juan Merchan. Get this case resolved. And even though there are petitions that are going to be filed to postpone it further, shouldn't happen. But Judge Juan Merchan has the prerogative to do that in his exercise as the judge presiding over those cases. Lots of considerations there, but that's going to happen in the weeks just ahead. Certainly not overcoming the news of Donald Trump's election, but certainly also affected by his election. We've got a second case, a second state court case. We know what that is all about, too. We have talked about it a lot here on the broadcasts of Amicus, here on the stations of Civic Media. That's the question of what is the procedural status? What is the condition of that other state case? That's the Georgia case. Again, neither one of these is federal. Important to keep in mind, both of these are state cases. The state case, you may recall, that omnibus, that sweeping, that huge RICO case, that racketeer-influenced and corrupt organizations prosecution brought by, yes, once again, grand juries in Georgia, Fulton County, that's where they're located, venued, charging Donald Trump and many others, 18 defendants altogether, with violations of Georgia law, alleging their interference in many ways with the Georgia election there in 2020. Things like, yes, fake electors. We had them here in Wisconsin. Other states, at least five or six others, they had them there as well. Fannie Willis through the grand jury process, charging that, charging misrepresentations to the Georgia legislature, charging that various defendants went into particular precincts in Georgia to try to influence the counting of votes, all kinds of things, alleging an enterprise to undermine the voters there in Georgia. We know already that a few of those defendants have pled guilty, most of them lawyers. We know their names as well. Most of them lawyers who have pled guilty to some of the counts in that indictment, but many of those also remain. So what is the status of that? Is a trial coming up soon in that state case? The answer is no, because two things have happened as well in what's called this pretrial setting, presided over here by Judge Scott McAfee. Scott McAfee in Georgia, Juan Merchan in New York. Same kinds of judges, state court judges, both non-federal judges. Scott McAfee did two things. One, as you may recall well, that he found that Fannie Willis, the DA there in Fulton County, that she could, in fact, remain on the case. Why? Because even though she had this relationship with another member of her prosecution team, the judge found that that was untoward, inappropriate, and an appearance of impropriety, but not significantly a conflict of interest significant to prompt her removal from the prosecution of the case. And he made that determination, and Donald Trump and other defendants opposed that result. And so that case is now up on appeal. And that case is up on appeal to a Georgia appeals court. And that appeals court is entertaining whether or not Judge McAfee was right in making that decision to keep Fannie Willis on the case, or he was wrong. And they're already soliciting and getting briefs from the parties, oral arguments from the parties. That's the part of the appellate process. And sometime fairly soon, it's been pending for a while now, the appeals court in Georgia will issue an opinion on whether or not Scott McAfee was right to keep Fannie Willis in that position, or Donald Trump and other defendants were right in requesting and requiring that she be removed from the case. That opinion is still pending. Along the way, while the case is up there on the Court of Appeals, Fannie Willis also took her own appeal. She said, gee, while we're before the Court of Appeals, let me raise something that Scott McAfee did that was contrary to the prosecution interests. Scott McAfee, you may recall, dismissed about six counts of the indictment against Donald Trump and the others, finding they were improperly pled. Fannie Willis has also appealed that decision, and that is also pending before the Court of Appeals there in Georgia. We're waiting for that decision. Scott McAfee doing a few things, pretrial matters with respect to other defendants in the case. But none of that is prompting the scheduling of a trial there in Georgia. All of that now pending on appeal, meaning no trial scheduled in front of Scott McAfee. The case is still alive, as is the case in front of Juan Merchan up north in New York. And when we come back, we'll talk about the implications of Donald Trump's elections on both of those cases, Georgia and New York. What does it mean? What does it mean for the future of those cases as we discuss these here on Amicus, a Law Review?
You're listening to the Talk of Green Bay, WGBW, home for Nightlight with Pete Schwabe.
Brr, the weather is getting chilly, so come warm up indoors at Heights Pub & Parlor, located at 217 North Washington Street in downtown Green Bay, and enjoy a relaxing atmosphere, friendly service, and delicious food. Grab a signature panini or prime Angus burger for lunch, have dinner with friends and a featured entree, or stop by for after-work drinks during happy hour. And don't forget to book your holiday party or special event in our private upstairs parlor, as 2024 dates are filling fast. Like and follow us on Facebook or head to heightsgb.com to learn more.
Let's get back to live music in the lair with Kaylin Cole. The next song you have for us tonight is called 1103. Yes. Is that a time or a flight number?
Oh, that's actually really good. That's a good idea. I think I might have to write another song with that. You'll get 50%.
It's live in the lair. Grab the podcast now at maxincradio.com and listen live on Saturday night, 6 to midnight, across the Civic Media Radio Network.
This is the talk of Green Bay, WGBW.
This is Amicus Law Review here on the broadcast stations of Civic Media. Thank you for joining me and my outstanding producer, Greg, as we talk all about the four cases pending against President-elect Donald Trump. What's the status of those, and how will the presidency, his election to that office, be affecting those cases? We've talked about the New York case, Donald Trump scheduled to be sentenced for his criminal conduct in just a few weeks by Judge Juan Merchan. That's the status of that. Anticipating appeals on that, that will probably bring that case well into 2025, maybe even 2026 before it's completely resolved. And then we've got the Georgia case also being prosecuted there in Fulton County. That case right now principally on appeal as to Donald Trump and many other defendants on these issues of whether or not the prosecutor can continue to serve in that role. We're awaiting a decision there as well. But in the midst of that, this other significant political event happening, and that is the election by the people of America of Donald Trump as our next president. So how will those New York and Georgia criminal cases that are still pending against President-elect be affected by his presidency? Well, a couple of fundamental notions that also are going to be important as we turn next in our next hour to a discussion of those federal cases. Very different disposition as to them. News coming out of Washington, D.C. just late this past week. But because both the New York and the Georgia cases are state cases, they're not federal cases. They're not being brought by or administered by in any way the U.S. Department of Justice or by Jack Smith, who is the special counsel in those federal cases, about which we will talk a lot in just a few moments. Because they're state cases, there is no way in which the U.S. Department of Justice, the Attorney General, the present Attorney General, a future Attorney General, there is no way in which a President of the United States of America, even exercising inappropriate authority over the Department of Justice, could stop those prosecutions. Contrary to what you've seen from some voices in Congress, even from Donald Trump, it is not the case that a federal officer can direct how a state officer, a state prosecutor, a state judge acts. That's the reason why we've got a constitution that brings together 50 states under a federal system, but nonetheless preserves states' rights. This is one of those areas where it's important to understand the difference between those. And because of it, the truth is that an attorney general, even a new attorney general, a new president coming in on January 20th, cannot reach out. Not to say that there wouldn't be an attempt to do this, but cannot reach out and direct by virtue of official authority under the Constitution that those prosecutions be stopped, the cases be dismissed, and they be finished. That cannot happen, nor as we will talk in greater length, not only in response to one of your calls, but also in connection with my seven theses about the power now vested in Washington, D.C., under the pardon authority of the Constitution, Section 2, Article 2, granting the president pardon authority. Pardons likewise apply only to federal cases, not to state prosecutions. So nothing that a president, with the support or the non-support of the Department of Justice in going ahead to grant pardons to people, can't grant pardons for state offenses, only federal offenses. And so that authority also cannot be exercised by Donald Trump or any president to affect the outcome of state cases. Even so, and here's the point, in the last moments of this, our first hour of Amicus, here's the other point. Let us suppose that those cases go ahead, New York and Georgia, unaffected by any movement by a Department of Justice or by a new president coming in. And at some point in 2025, maybe 2026, as those appeals and the trials are conducted, they reach resolution. And at some point, a judge, Scott McAfee, Juan Merchan, maybe in a few weeks, affirmed by appeals courts. The answer is the cases are now done. And there is a judgment that is entered in each of them as to this defendant. His name is Donald John Trump. What happens then when the state of Georgia says, we're done, we're ready to execute, we're ready to impose this judgment now in the wake of all of these appeals? What happens in New York when the people of New York say the appeals are now exhausted and we can now execute, we can go ahead with the judgment entered by Juan Merchan? The question is, can a state come to 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue and say, Mr. President, it is time for you to surrender yourself and submit to the jurisdiction of New York and or Georgia? It's an untested question, and certainly the Supreme Court would address this as well, very likely, as all these things go up on appeal, arguably even the judgments going up, arguably, to the United States Supreme Court. Supreme Court never having resolved this, because we've never had a situation before in our nation's history where a president in office is subject to review by and the imposition of judgment by a state court. There is a non-frivolous. We've talked a lot about frivolous arguments. We've seen a lot of those cases in America. A lot of them brought by Donald Trump and his political allies have no merit to them. Those are frivolous actions. They've mucked up our judiciary in many ways. But there is a non-frivolous argument, not necessarily advocating for it, that states like New York, like Georgia, cannot overcome the electoral will of a majority of the national population, the majority will finding that Donald Trump is our next president. A state independent of the entire nation independently supplant the electoral will of the overwhelming majority of the American population by prosecuting and potentially incarcerating, imprisoning a sitting president. There is a non-frivolous argument that that would be unconstitutional. That also not tested. Not advocating here that that is a right position, but if in fact Georgia and New York at some point in the years ahead, this is not happening anytime soon, but if those cases survive into 2025 and 2026, anticipate the argument being made, maybe even to the United States Supreme Court, that the final imposition of sentences, those criminal sentences against a sitting president, if those happen in New York and in Georgia, that they cannot be executed until after he leaves office, when in January of 2029, presumably. And it's only then that a state could come and say, Mr. now former president, it is time for you to serve your sentence in our state. And again, the theory, untested, unknown, of uncertain credibility would be that a state independent of the rest of America cannot impose its judgment and basically take a president away from his, one day her, office as a result of the judgment entered in that state. It is a fascinating theory. We have never tested this before because we've never had a president-elect and soon to be president who's facing this kind of criminal exposure. We'll talk about Donald Trump's continuing criminal exposure in those all-important federal cases as we continue here in Amicus, a Law Review, in our second hour of discussion about justice, courts, and the administration of the rule of law.
You're listening to the Talk of Green Bay, WGBW, home of Mino and the Mayor.
John Mino and Jim Schmidt.
Monday is Veterans Day. I'll be doing a portion of the show from the Duck Creek VFW Breakfast for Veterans.
And Brian Gottlieb from Tundraland joins us to talk about their Baths for the Brave program. Join us.
Mino and the Mayor, weekday mornings 6 till 9.
Wisconsin Decides 2024, and this is the only place you received election results from across the state live.
And you're responding to our coverage.
I just want to thank you for being there for us.
Wisconsin is not people that are sore losers.
So no matter what happens, there will be a tomorrow, and that's what I'm looking forward to.
Here for you after the election or any time.
Real news and great conversation on 97.9 WGBW and the Civic Media app. Your news, conversations, and a whole lot of fun. It's all on your local Civic Media radio station or the Civic Media app. You're listening to the Talk of Green Bay.
WGBW 1590 AM Denmark. W250 CV Green Bay.
And always streaming on the Civic Media app.